As a half-Burmese Unitarian Universalist, as Ed said, I'll reflect on the complex ways spirituality, culture, and daily life intertwine in Myanmar, and invite us to consider what insights my family's religion might offer our own spiritual journeys. I want to be clear from the beginning. My mother's family lives in Myanmar. This will not be a critique of the Burmese government. And frankly, I don't think we're in any position to cast stones, given what's happening right here in the United States. Instead, I want to share something more personal, how Buddhism as practice in Myanmar shaped my own spiritual understanding, how it weaves through everyday life, and how I see it connecting to our values as Unitarian Universalists. Burmese Buddhism is an intricate blend of Theravada Buddhism and Myanmar's older animist traditions. Pagodas often hold space for both Buddhas and Nats, the ancestral spirits still honored across the country. My first religious awakening happened in Myanmar. I was a child visiting family in Yangon. They took me to the Swedagon Pagoda, as seen here, the most sacred Buddhist site in the country. As you can see, it stands tall on a hill, glowing with gold leaf and reverence, visible from nearly every point in the city. I walked barefoot across the hot tiles to pour water over my birthday sign, Saturday. This is the Saturday corner in this slide where I stood. I was wearing a lungi, the traditional Burmese wraparound skirt like I'm wearing now. You can see, I'll get out from over here. Anyway, at the time, it was new to me because I was 8, and I remember being nervous it might fall down. Spoiler alert, I've worn a lungi many times and it's never fallen down. I'm proud to wear it now, and this service is a rare occasion I get to wear it. Anyway, at the time I was nervous, and nervousness always makes my disability worse. My hands were shaking as I poured the water, first over the Buddha, and then the knot, which you could see in gold, below, which is the Naga or serpentine knot. But no one noticed my hand shaking, or if they did, they didn't care. They had welcomed me with joy, and I just wanted to show respect for my family and for my family's culture. I didn't expect to feel much by the simple act of pouring water, and yet I did. I felt an overwhelming sense of calmness and love. And this photo is actually of my daughter, who has the same birthday, Saturday, as me. So she's doing the same thing. If I could go to a Burmese temple regularly, I would. I return to Myanmar whenever I can, and I always go to Shwe Dagon. On our most recent trip, I took my husband to the Sunday corner, his birthday. He poured water over the Buddha and below the Sunday birthday knot, a Garuda. I don't know if you can see the wings there. It's a half bird, half person. Then we took our son to the Thursday corner, his birthday sign, and watched him pour Buddha water over the Buddha and the rat. I hope you can see the rat there. each of us honoring our birthdays. The Shui Dagon literally glows, not just metaphorically. Its domes are covered in real gold, and LED lights flash from the Buddha's head, as you might be able to see in this picture. But it's not spectacle, it's not Disneyland, which also has a lot of LED lights. It's a living, breathing, spiritual space. One that, like many sacred sites around the world, blends reverence with state symbolism. Tourists wander with cameras and sun hats, while families kneel in prayer or gently pour water over statues. See the guard standing watch, if you can see in the middle of the picture there. And that's the booth where you pay if you're a tourist. You're required to pay an entrance fee and wear, quote, modesty clothes. Not necessarily a loan tee, but definitely no shorts for anyone, men or women. You're also required to be barefoot. And guards will shoo away anyone not dressed appropriately. A small but clear reminder that they're guests in a space still shaped by devotion. Here's a shrine built by the wealthy to honor their ancestors with TV screens. You can see on the right, that's a TV screen of the Buddha. Notice the family praying and the two boys turn to look at the camera. It's a contrast of crowds and silent spaces. There are stones in the patterns you can walk on. You're walking barefoot, so you notice the ground a lot more, how different stones absorb or reflect heat. That was the first meditation I learned. We learned these rituals from those who came before us. Here's my uncle teaching the newest generation how to offer incense. You can see my little nephew there. For once, my nephew wasn't trying to reach for the tip of the burning incense. I don't know what my uncle said to him, but at that age, it was a minor miracle to see him standing quietly, and that's why I took that photo. It's not just people we learn from, it's the spirits too, or knots, the ones that linger in walls, in shrines, in old stories passed down. Knots are covered in this incense wall. Knots don't just live in temples, they live everywhere, in people's homes, in nature. Most home altars incorporate them. Westerners call this animism, but to me, it feels like an older layer of belief, like what we heard earlier in our story for all ages, where everything has a spirit. As Ed said in his reflection, Buddhism as practiced by ordinary people, like me, in Sri Lanka or Myanmar, isn't about philosophy or doctrine. It's not an intellectual pursuit. It's ritual. It's everyday practice. It lives in homes and temples. It is what you do. Meditation isn't always about sitting still, although you can see a lot of people there are sitting still, but if you notice in the background, there are also people who are in the process of moving. The secret is in motion as much as in silence. You can walk along these green tiles in a quieter part of the temple and meditate. And many boys become monks for a short time as a rite of passage. In this slide, the two boys in the background, as you can probably see, with shaved heads and brown robes, are most likely temporary monks, since they didn't choose a quiet area to do their walking. And one isn't actually meditating, as you may be able to see, but is instead looking at the camera. And Buddhism is not confined to monasteries or temples. If you open a Burmese English language newspaper, like 11myanmar.com, you'll find Buddhist quotes tucked between articles about weather and politics. Like, if you can't find peace within, no place will offer you peace without. where suffering exists, but so does compassion. Westerners are often confused when Buddhism says life is suffering. They think it's like sin, but it's not. Sin is about moral failure. It has an origin story, Adam and Eve, something to overcome, to be forgiven for. But suffering in Buddhism is just part of being an ordinary human. We love and we lose, that hurts. We get hungry, as mentioned in the quotes. We age, we get sick, even joy fades. That's suffering too. The goal isn't to avoid suffering unless you become a monk or a nun, it's to understand it. Suffering comes from attachment, yes, but ordinary people are attached, not just to others, but to everyday things like eating. And that's where compassion comes in, not as a rule, but as a natural result of realizing we all suffer. To many Burmese, with their large extended families, there is actually no word for cousin, only brother or sister. So my cousin is my brother or sister. And multiple generations often live together. Westerners suffer from a lack of family. I was regularly asked how I live in the US, and while they were impressed with our cars, got a lot of questions about that, my Burmese family expressed compassion that I lived only with my siblings and my parents, with other relatives miles away. This gets at some of the complexity of Buddhism as a state religion. If Western life is presented in its entirety as a contrast with Burmese life, many aspects, particularly its individualism, can seem to go directly against Buddhism. And most Burmese people aren't monks, but nearly everyone practices. Children offer flowers at the altar, people visit temples on the full moon, and there's a lot of reverence for monks, who most monks and nuns devote their lives to Buddhism. Here's one you can see in there. Living simply and intentionally. They wear the same robes that have been worn for centuries. You can see the brown. They shave their heads, walk barefoot to receive alms, are ritually begging for food, and they don't eat before noon. Their life is one of renunciation, but their relationship with lay people is mutual. The community provides food and shelter. And you can see us here, next slide, here we are receiving spiritual teachings and blessings. It's a shared spiritual economy. And it's deeply gendered, like most of Burmese culture. Most revered figures are men. Explaining Burmese gender roles would be its own sermon, but here are a few highlights. In Burmese culture, the husband goes to live with the wife's family. Women are considered emotionally stable and better with practical matters. Men have what's called a pawn, which I'm sure my mom would say I'm mispronouncing. I'm sure I am. It's a mix of what we might call fragile male ego and quick temper. So maybe the men who become monks have overcome their pawn and are wiser for it? I don't know, since I learned about pawn from a book. My uncle speaks the best English, and in a culture where sex segregation is a norm, it would be rude to ask. I'm not sure I would even ask someone in the US this question. It would be kind of difficult to say, do you have a pawn? Female monks, nuns, the female on the right side of this slide with pink robes, receive less recognition and support. Yet here this nun is alone doing a walking meditation. A woman who wasn't a nun would never be alone. Her family would be with her. I say this not to defend sexism, but that Burmese gender roles are different. One of the worst insults a Burmese wife can say to her husband is a phrase that I won't literally translate for you, but it means, you are not treating me as an equal. And this is in a culture where direct statements are not typically made, where if you want someone to turn on the light, you say, it's dark. Myanmar. In this cart is a hot air balloon for tourists. In Myanmar, religion and state are closely intertwined. The government presents itself as deeply religious, aligned with the people's values. I don't know why my mic is cutting out. I hope you can still hear me. Like the US, whose money says it uses religious imagery and quotes to show it shares the people's beliefs. President Trump often wraps himself in Christian symbolism, holding a Bible, invoking God, aligning with religious beliefs, aligning with religious leaders. Religion can inspire, but it can also legitimize power. And that too is something Buddhism warns us about. Attachment, ego, illusion, whether individual or institutional. This is where our Yuyu tradition asks us to hold complexity. We affirm wisdom wherever we can find it, but we also know any tradition, ours included, can be misused. I love my family's culture. I see the good, and I know that power and faith don't always serve people equally. So what does that mean for us as UUs? We don't have one sacred text, we don't follow one doctrine, but we affirm the worth and dignity of every person. We seek truth and meaning. We practice compassion. Many of us draw from Buddhist teachings, like the centering words that I used. We sing meditation chants, like meditation on breathing. But we sometimes forget spirituality is not just a philosophy, and that part of our mission statement is to deepen our spiritual lives. We need to show up. We have our own rituals. We ring a bell at every service, though not as big as this one. What would it mean to wash the Buddha? We do light a candle, but what if we, on our birthday, not because we believe in Buddhism or even anything, but because we believe in marking time with ritual? What if we stopped separating the spiritual from the mundane? I don't want to romanticize Burmese Buddhism. Like any tradition, it has its limits. It can exclude, it can be patriarchal, it can be conservative, but it has endured through colonization, through diaspora. It has offered ordinary people peace, purpose, and belonging. And for me, it offered my first glimpse of what religion could be. Not just belief, but a way of walking through the world. When I think of the Shwe Dagon, I see the gold, its spires rising up above the city, brilliant even in twilight. I hear the chants. I smell the incense. I see the people praying, walking or sitting, or meditating. And I remember spirituality, and I remember washing the Buddha and my knot. And I remember spirituality is not always grand, even though the Shwe Dagon is grand, but it's often small, repeated acts pouring water, kneeling, walking with purpose, pausing in silence. We may not all chant or meditate, but we too practice ritual as we're doing right now, seeking something that helps us face the suffering of this world, not to turn away, but to meet it with compassion. Thank you.